Good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Great.
All right. Well, let's get this going here. We are recording. I'll go ahead and do an introduction for you. Today I am interviewing Dr. Robert Price. He received his Master in Theological Studies and New Testament from Gordon Cornwell Theological Seminary. Was awarded a PhD in systematic theology and the New Testament at Drew University. And it says you served as a professor of religion at Mount Olive College. He's written some good books on the mythical Jesus or the Christ myth, deconstructing Jesus, Jesus is Dead, the historical Jesus, Five Views, and the Case Against the Case for Christ. So I wanted to start it off with a little bit about your background. So you were formerly a Baptist minister. So what took you on a journey where you went from preaching about Jesus and believing that story to believing that Jesus was a myth?
Well, actually, before I became a pastor, I had attended the same church because despite my loss of any kind of Orthodox faith previously, this place was so open-minded and so diverse. The pastor himself, I guess, had been Southern Baptist. He was a Texan originally, and he had broadened his perspective by a lot of reading of Kierkegaard and various others, and he had a wide range of interest. And I was still, I guess I was still some kind of a theist at the time. But I guess I was already in league with thinkers like Bultmann and Tillich, and so I believed in a historical Jesus. But I kind of figured, like Rudolf Bultmann argued, that he had been an apocalyptic prophet of sorts, that he didn't believe that he was the Messiah, that he certainly didn't think that he was God and all that. And that the miracles probably, insofar as anything actually happened in the Gospels, it was a bunch of cases of psychosomatic healing. It all has to do with the principle of analogy that, as Bultmann said, since we see exorcisms and faith healing today, however you think it works, that you can go to meetings and see such things happening. So there's no reason to deny that they did, and so on. I said, yeah, it makes good sense to me. But the more I got into reading people like George Wells, who wrote a bunch of books arguing that Jesus was a myth, comparable to William Tell and others. At first, I thought it was sort of crazy, like they say, conspiracy theory and all that. But then I began thinking, well, let me see if I can be teachable about this, if I can bring myself to honestly consider some of these points. And the more I did, in fact, I was preparing a course on the life and teaching of Jesus at the time, and I thought to myself, I'd heard him speak, and he said, well, of course, my view never gets a hearing. Nobody can bring themselves to consider it seriously. And I thought, well, I want to take that dare. I want to be as open-minded as I can about this. And I didn't just accept what he and others said. I just began to ponder them. And I was already, as I say, more of a liberal Protestant, not so much politically like today, where liberal Christianity simply is left-wing politics. But I was more in the critical camp, and I preached on the Bible, no problem. But I had given up evangelicalism some years before I ever became a pastor. So people always understandably get the wrong idea when they say, this guy used to be a Baptist preacher. Well, not exactly. It was a lot more complicated and vague than that. Well, the thing that really propelled me across the line to say, I think it's more likely that there wasn't a Jesus, or should I say, that the burden of proof really would lie with those even like Bultmann that said that, yeah, there was a Jesus. Bultmann said nobody who's not insane would deny that Jesus existed. And I thought, well, that's probably not really the case. You don't have to be a nut. And what really convinced me was for some months, I was reading a bunch of different books where scholars would take this or that element in the gospel story and say, you know, that kind of looks like it's a rewrite of so-and-so in the Old Testament, like the feeding stories and so on. Yeah. With some borrowings probably from the Odyssey and all that. And I looked at each one of these arguments, and though some of them struck me as pretty iffy, a lot of them seemed to me very compelling. And I came to the point where I thought, I don't think there's a single gospel story or even in the book of Acts that wouldn't make better sense as a rewrite of something, especially in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament. And I thought, well, if this is the case, why is it the case? Why is there nothing that would stand out as what you might call secular evidence, like no real biographical information about Jesus, nothing to connect him with the history of the times, even the stories where Jesus is connected with someone who we know existed, like Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, Herod the Great. These stories are all highly dubious for other reasons entirely. The characters are grossly out of character, like Pilate. Oh boy, I can't let that Jesus guy get executed. What's the matter with him? And so on. Or the high priest is presiding over a trial for Jesus on Passover Eve. Wait a second. Somebody didn't know what they're describing. And so I thought, why is there any reason to believe in this when just about everything seems to be either rewritten Old Testament or so similar to other ancient stories, such as the dying and rising savior gods, which do predate the Gospels, no matter what these apologists say, they're just playing fast and loose with the evidence. Then, or healing stories like those attributed to Asclepius, the healing god, et cetera, et cetera. I thought, what is there left? I mean, there might have been a historical Jesus, but once you take this stuff away, what was he? And I thought to myself, it's as if somebody 100 years from now came to believe that Superman actually existed. And then he realized, well, you know, some of this stuff couldn't really have happened. Let's find the historical Superman. We'll examine all the comics and see that, you know, if there's some factual undergirding. And oh, there is. And here's the news, folks. The historical Superman was Clark Kent, a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper. What? That's it? That was Superman? How did this religion get started on the basis of a guy like this? And people just like Bart Ehrman and a lot of these guys, they just don't seem to see the incongruity and the meagerness of the evidence. And so there might have been one. And in fact, shut up in a second. There's at least one quite viable sketch of a historical Jesus, and that would be that of S.G.F. Brandon and others, who said that Jesus could have been a revolutionist who was crucified not on a frame-up, but because he was actually trying to rally Jews against the Romans. Some others made a very good case for that. So I don't approach Christ mythicism as a dogma. I realize every historical judgment has to be tentative and provisional, open to re-examination. So my stance is that it just seems to me to be the most adequate way of looking at the evidence. And if somebody finds something you could show as a real letter from or about Jesus, Well, it's okay with me. That's all it would take. All right, there was one. I don't think it'd be better if there wasn't a Jesus. I don't feel like this scorched earth approach to Christianity, but somehow that's absurd and neurotic. I don't go to church anymore. I don't believe in any kind of a personal God, but that's a whole different issue than whether there was a historical Jesus. And I think there might have been, and maybe he was the one Brandon talked about. Makes sense, but I don't see how we'll ever know.
Yeah, that's very, very valid points. So within your view of the Christ myth, that there's a potential historical Jesus, you see him maybe as a revolutionary, a zealot, or something along those lines. Because, yeah, that was my question, because a lot of times I've been called a mythicist because from what I look at, the New Testament is a mythological version of what a historical Jesus might have been. So when I'm pointing to what seems like myth making, and then I'm pointing out that there's a historical Jesus contrary to what you see in the mythological version in the New Testament. I don't know. I feel like I fall in the historical Jesus camp, but and maybe, you know, you can help me clarify some of those points, but I feel like that's a valid point, that there was probably a historical Jesus. We're never really going to know for sure. There is a consensus, it seems, within the historical Jesus camp about the baptism and the crucifixion. Outside of that, debatable what he was or did or did not do. But I wanted to ask you about the alleged evidence to support Jesus' existence. You know, when we, so like one of the first things that I found interesting was James Tabor's book on the Talpiot tomb, the lost tomb of Jesus, and then the James ossuary. Is this evidence that there was a historical Jesus? And I mean, how do you look at that evidence?
That to me is utterly unconvincing, partly because of the argument from the names. It says that this is Jesus, the son of Joseph, brother of James. James, the brother of Jesus, son of Joseph, and all that. Buried with them are Mariam and a couple of other names. And they say, these were all admittedly common names of the period, but this particular collection of them, what are the chances that you would have these mostly matching New Testament characters all together? It's got to be them. I said that is just, I think, ridiculous, because for one thing, you don't have the exact correspondence upon which this theory rests. You can't just cut off a few of the names that are not in the New Testament and say, wow, this is a perfect match for those characters. No, it isn't. If it was just these, maybe. Also, what are they doing buried in Jerusalem? They're all supposed to be Galileans. I mean, that's important. And yeah. The ossuary beyond that, there are two different handwritings on it. They've admitted from the first that I think it's the brother of Jesus part is written in after the fact by somebody else. Forget it, right there. It goes down in flames. And plus, these tests of the patina on it seem to indicate that though the rock box is old, the carving is not, because you can see where it's engraved that does not have the same coloring and texture and so on, so that it's more recently put together. I tend to really, in my opinion, who was the author that I know him personally? I'm getting old and senile, I'm blanking on his name. He wrote The Jesus Dynasty. I found that book, for instance, really slipshod in its historical reasoning. It's almost like holy blood, holy grail. Hey, what if this were really that? And that was connected to this? Well, what if? I mean, that's like a Leonard Nimoy show. It's not it's not really historical evidence. And this is more of the same. It's just wild guesswork and something that is itself highly dubious cannot really function as firm evidence for something else you're debating. So to me, that means nothing. I mean, if you could actually show this was true, great. I would welcome that. I'm not rooting for one side in this, but that seems to me to be just desperate. And it reveals this insecurity of their case to have to, it's like the Shroud of Turin thing. Some people are still dragging that in. Forget it. It just doesn't work. They misrepresent the evidence. There could have been a Jesus, but especially with the Shroud, they say there's no other way this image could have been there unless it was Jesus rising from the dead. And it was that radioactivity from the miracle. What are you talking about? Using one miracle to prove another one. It's just so lame, I think. You'd really need some kind of reliably contemporary attestation. Now, Bart Ehrman and others are right. It's not like you're going to look at an American history book 100 years from now and see a big feature on Oral Roberts because he was a faith hero. You know, that was even true in the old days. There were loads of people like this. So you wouldn't expect it necessarily. But given the Jesus depicted in the Gospels, that he is followed by huge crowds everywhere he goes. They all bring their sick and demon-possessed relatives, and he heals every single one of them. You're dealing with a comic book here. I mean, there's no parallel in anybody's memory or in historical documents for something like that. And even the teaching. I'm doing another book on the Gospels right now. And it really occurred to me for the first time, Jesus is said to be teaching every Sabbath to big crowds in synagogues. And he goes from city to city and he's teaching them so long that everybody is sick and they're going to faint from hunger if he doesn't miraculously feed them. What was he saying? I mean, that implies a pretty big body of teaching. And when you look at the Gospels, it's just a few fortune cookie sayings and very sketchy in the literal sense. I mean, very terse, non-detailed stories of healing, and that's it? I mean, or a few parables that are equivocal and very short. What was this guy really a teacher? It just seems to me, the deeper I look at it, to be. Now, I like all the stuff. I mean, I love the Gospels. I love the Jesus character. But I have a historian's conscience here that I can't just go along with this as history. Of course, I don't think it's supposed to be history even.
Yeah.
It's very moving and challenging material. It's great stuff. But history, I don't think so.
Yeah. I noticed your background. You've got the superheroes in your background. But yeah, you mentioned the Jesus dynasty. That's Robert Eisman and his hypothesis that the Qumran community, the Essenes, are really, I guess, what like James and his community and Jesus and them. He sees, I think, James as a teacher of righteousness. I mean, I'm totally sketchy on that, but the similarities between the teachings and the archetypes of the Qumran community in the New Testament, I find striking. I don't see any connective tissue that they're the same. I don't see anything to do that. But I do find it as background information to inform the cultural milieu that the New Testament is in, and at least kind of helps define the kind of Judaism that might have influenced the Jesus message. I mean, I guess how do you see Qumran and the Essene community situated in relationship to the message of the historical Jesus?
Well, by the way, James Tabor is the name I was trying to remember.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote The Jesus Dynasty. Robert Eisenman's the one that wrote James, the Brother of Jesus, and all
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was mixing
I find his work very important and convincing. I realize Eisenman. It's debatable, but it strikes me he just has this incredible insight into the way people wrote scripture and understood it at the time. And so many of the things he points out between stuff in the book of Acts and in the Gospels and in Josephus even that look like they're reflected in the Gospels rewritten a bit, that I find him very convincing about James. Barbara Thiering argues that that the teacher of righteousness was John the Baptist. Actually, that makes sense, too. It's hard to choose between them. And in fact, both could be true, since presumably there was a succession of men in this office. Yeah. I also think that Eisenman was right, as was a previous scholar, Jacob Tyker, who argued that the Qumran community was the Jerusalem church. I think that's very likely, and that Paul, this gets into, I know, weird territory, seldom discussed, but I think that Hermann Dettering and others were right, that Paul is the same under a different name as Simon Magus, the Gnostic founder and so forth, who we're told was a member of John the Baptist's sect. But after John's death, he would have been first in line to replace him, but he was off in Egypt at the time, and instead Dositheus of Samaria took over. But then the two of them clashed, and each founded his own sect. And some of the things said about John Simon in the book of Acts, in Irenaeus, and in the pseudo-Clementine literature, yeah, make it sound so Pauline that it seemed, and already F.C. Bauer was on the trail of this. He said when Simon is asking Peter, gee, this thing you did, imposing your hands and these people are speaking in tongues, I'd like to know how you did that. I'll be happy to pay for the knowledge. It's, what? This is, as J.B. Phillips put it in his translation, to hell with you and your money. You thought you could buy the gift of God with money? Well, what was he trying to do? The big point of that story is that even Philip the deacon, though he could convert all of these people in Samaria, he couldn't impart the Holy Spirit. Now, why not? They're even baptized. Well, you had to have Peter and John, the apostles, come up from Jerusalem. Only they can do it. So Bauer pointed out that that this looks like another version of the meeting in Galatians between Paul and the so-called pillars, where they would acknowledge his legitimacy, but he had to collect tribute from his congregations to support them. And Bauer said, there's an echo in here somewhere. Isn't that what Simon is doing? He wants the prerogatives of apostleship, and here's a few bucks for it.
Yeah.
And that really struck me, and that's not the whole case even. So it could easily be a lot of nonsense, but all you've got is a few mosaic tiles to try to complete the picture with. And I find that dovetailing with Eisenman to a great degree, to where I think you can kind of hypothetically figure out who was who and what they did. Now, do you need a Jesus for that? Not necessarily, because the way I understand it, you know how with Jesus, he's got 12 apostles and an inner circle of three, the pillars. At Qumran, there was a council of 12 and a separate group, but still an inner circle of three. And where would there have been room for Jesus? Well, my guess is that Simon Magus / Paul sought rapprochement with the Jerusalem church / Qumran community. And that's and he sort of purchased it by the promise of tribute to the mother church. But part of the condition would have been that they believe in the spiritual Christ, because Irenaeus tells us that Simon taught that he had been Christ and had been crucified in a semblance without actually feeling pain. So he's saying you should make me under the guise of Jesus as your figurehead, and the rest of you will sort of be put in the shadows, but he's not here, so you're in charge here, whereas I'll stay away and just go between my churches. Who knows, but that seems to me to make a lot of sense of some of the weird little anomalies and loose ends we find. So I don't know that there needed to have been a historical Jesus at the root of this. He only got historicized in the midst of competing claims by Gnostics and others who said, oh, I got another revelation from Jesus, which is just what you see in the Nag Hammadi texts, like in the Apocryphon of James. Yeah, we apostles are all sitting around one day having revelations, and Jesus said to me, well, Irenaeus commented on that stuff, and he said, you guys are just playing, can you top this? So, yeah, Jesus said that to you. Well, here's what he said to me. It's all subjective. But we have an actual historical founder. So we have the copyright on it. You guys are just spinning your wheels. So I think that's why they decided, oh, yeah, there was a Jesus, and not long ago. And he taught our leaders, who taught their successors all the way on to us. You're just making it up as you go along. Yeah. So that was the view of what's his name? I'm really bad on the names lately. Good God, snap out of it, Price. The guy that wrote Arthur Drews or Droves or Dreves, I don't know how you pronounce it in Dutch. But this guy made that argument. He said they needed a historical founder to, you know, keep the copyright. Of course, then the Gnostics started doing that too, right? They said, we Valentinians, our guru was taught by Theotis, who was a disciple of Paul. And then the Basilidian Gnostics said, well, now that you mention it, our guy was taught by Glaucius, who was the interpreter of Peter. So everybody starts playing the game and you're back to square one. The same thing we're doing today. You say the Bible says infant baptism. Well, I say believer's baptism. You're never going to get any agreement.
Yeah. Have you read the Anti-Nicene? It's the epistle of Peter to James and its reception, where he calls, he talks about my enemy. Would you situate that as Simon Magus or Paul? Yes. And this kind of brings me to a point that, the historical Jesus was an Aramaic speaking Jew who wore tzitzit, but the message of the New Testament, is basically written to a Greek-speaking community, and there's a disconnect between who this Aramaic-speaking Jesus was, if he existed. We can get more into that later, but if he existed within his Jewish framework, then the Gospels and the Epistles and the New Testament has this very Hellenistic, you know, perspective that seems to not fit into the Jewish understanding of, like, first century Judaism, Second Temple Judaism, and the interplay between, I guess, the community of, you know, James and John and Peter and the Pauline message there. I guess situating him as what they would call the enemy, and that in the Acts it was the Jerusalem Council. I'm trying to think, was that in Antioch or in Jerusalem where they had that? I don't believe that the story in Acts necessarily tells the true and correct telling of the decision at that council. But there was this thing between James and Peter and the Apostle Paul on the other side. What is your take on all that?
Well, there's something like it in Galatians, where And yeah, I'm really a nut here because I tend to go along with the Dutch radical critics who said that all of the epistles attributed to Paul are pseudonymous, that they all presuppose a later historical era and a later stage of Christian theologizing, and that they contradict one another even within the same text. Like in 1 Corinthians, like one chapter seems to contradict the argument of the previous one again and again and again, which is what gives exegetes nightmares trying to iron it out. Yeah. So, but it does seem to me that there was at some point an attempt, and the book of Acts, Ephesians, 1st and 2nd Peter, and the Gospel of Luke are all what Bauer called Catholicizing. They represent a later stage where Jewish Torah Christianity and Hellenistic Pauline Christianity, somebody was trying to get them together. The Jewish Christianity was on the decline and Hellenistic advancing. And so they said, hey, how about if we say that Peter and Paul were both instruments of Christ, and if you like the one, you have no business disliking the other. And that's why there's this pronounced parallelism between Peter and Paul in Acts. Both of them raise the dead, both cure lame people, both have miraculous prison breaks, both heal in superstitious manners, Peter's shadow, Paul's handkerchiefs and all that. Again, both preach to the Gentiles, and Peter even beats Paul to it. Paul was the apostle of the Gentiles, but now all of them are. What the heck? Bauer said, you see, there was an attempt to meld them together, not that it worked completely. You still had the Hellenistic Gnostics holding out over here and the Ebionite Jewish Christians over there, but that always happens, I guess. I think that is one of the attempts to present that as that reconciliation as happening at the very beginning. It's like a propagandistic rewrite of the history of it. I think that, yeah, there's something to it, but not quite what it's billed as. And that isn't just to debunk the story. It's not inerrant. Look at these contradictions. No, it's to recognize that these little anomalies and contradictions are valuable clues to sort of pry up the plates and see what really happened here, which is very instructive, it seems to me. So I think that there is a historical basis to that, but that Paul was the enemy. In Galatians, he said, what, have I become the enemy just by telling you the truth? Or the parable of the wheat and the tares? We thought we planted wheat. Where did these tares come from? He says, an enemy has done this. Now, I could be reading way too much into it, but it sort of sounds to me like, who's he talking about? It's like in Qumran, they're talking about somebody. They're just using euphemisms and so on. It's got to be Paul. When the day of judgment comes and people are going to be knocking on the pearly gates saying, hey, let us in. And Jesus says, gee, I'm sorry, you're not on the list. Well, wait a minute. We used to cast out demons in your name and so on. Look, I'm sorry. I don't know. Get out of here. You workers of anomia, lawlessness. Who's he talking about? It's got to be Paul. And so forth. So I think you can, once you put these lenses on, things really leap into focus. Though I admit it's all tentative, but who knows?
Yeah. So you don't think the seven most authentic epistles of Paul are actually attributed to him, that they're potentially pseudonymous or like written?
Yeah, that is what I think. For instance, there are references to Paul or whoever says to the Thessalonians, now you keep to the traditions as I delivered them to you. Traditions? Didn't he just start this religion? What traditions? Or his retrospective angle on like the church at Corinth. Now, I planted, Apollos watered, and so on. He sounds like he's looking back on some decades here. Mm-hmm. Or when in 1 Thessalonians, he says, well, you've been persecuted just like the Lord Jesus, but don't worry, God's wrath has finally caught up with him. What could he be talking about? It has to be the destruction of Jerusalem in 70, or the whole idea that, yeah, Jews have neglected to jump on board the gospel bandwagon here. How would you know that in the year 60 AD? That seems to me to presuppose a much later time. Or in Colossians, the gospel has been preached throughout the world. How'd you do that? Airplanes?
Yeah.
And so there are a bunch of things like that.
Okay. I wanted to kind of get into some of the main points of your Christ myth theory. Hmm. You assert that the epistles were written earlier than the gospels, and they provide no evidence of a recent historical Jesus. And there's no mentions of a miracle working Jesus in the secular sources. What do you make of the references from Thallos, Josephus, Tacitus, Marbar Serpon? And is there any validity to their claims? Like, what do you take of those attestations? Like, what is your sense about those?
Well, with Josephus, it seems to me almost a settled issue that it's got to be a spurious Christian addition. There have been a couple of approaches to this, partly from the narrative structure of it, as short as it is. I forget the guy's name, but this one scholar said, let's look at the number of Pontius Pilate episodes. They're written in a certain way where Pilate is always the protagonist. I don't mean the hero, but he's the one it's about. He did this, he did that. Whereas suddenly with the Jesus thing, he's mentioned only in subordinate clauses and so forth. It's not about him anymore. Somebody knew where to plug it in. Oh yeah, let's put it in the Pilate section, but it doesn't seem like it's the same writing structure, which doesn't change with people. Like their favorite vocabulary doesn't change. Another guy said that the first actual quoting of this we have is in Eusebius in the 4th century. And if you look at the context where it appears, it fits like a glove with the issues he is debating with his opponents about, was Jesus a god or a man or both? Did he do this? Did he do that? He says, well, I got something right here that shows that even a Jewish historian said, it looks kind of, it's just too good to be true. And there's other problems with it. We're told now that Vossius, who was, I guess, a Renaissance era, I forget, scholar, he claimed to have a copy of it that didn't have that in there. But of course, it's been destroyed, so we can't check it. So to me, that is so dubious and so unlikely to be authentic, though it has its defenders, that, again, you can't use that as a trump card. It's as equivocal as the original issue. Tacitus, there are serious doubts as to whether that is genuine, partly because the juicy idea of Christians being martyred by Nero never comes up for a couple of hundred years in Christian writings about martyrs and persecution. Why wouldn't they have appealed to this? Now, I have no idea. I'm less acquainted with that, but there are scholars that have said there are reasons to doubt that. Plus, he calls him Crestus, which was a common proper name, the useful one or the good one. Was he actually talking about Christ? Same thing with Suetonius. He said that Claudius exiled Jews from Rome because there was a guy named Crestus instigating rioting among the Jews. Was that Jesus? Was Jesus in Rome in the time of Claudius? Well, some people think so, like Barbara Thiering, but that would necessitate a gross rewriting of the chronology. With Mara ben Serapion, I think that who I believe is the one that said that they crucified their wise king, or was that Lucian of Samosata? But there's the Bar Serapion letter is undateable. There's really no, we don't know when that was written. And so it just seems to me you just don't have, I mean, there again, the sparsity and ambiguity of this supposed evidence actually accentuates how little there is. If you're really scraping the bottom of the bucket to say that this stuff proves there was a historical Jesus, you don't have that problem with others who were, people that like Caesar Augustus and so on, about whom some similar stories are told, because naturally people are going to talk about the Emperor of Rome. Here's Bart again saying, yeah, but Jesus wasn't as public a spectacle. Well, the only Jesus we hear about sure was, again, with these legions of fans and healing thousands of people. If you say, well, that's all legend, well, then what you got left? What are you defending? It just seems to me to run into a blank wall time and again.
Okay, so you assert that Eusebius, you think the testimony of Flavian was fabricated by Eusebius?
Probably.
I'm curious what you think of James Valiant's book on creating Christ and Joseph Atwill's Caesar's Messiah, because they assert that the Romans invented Christianity, one, to suppress the violent, like the zealots, the revolutionary, they were fighting for their Messiah. But they assert that the Romans invented Christianity as a typology of Joseph and the Flavian Emperor Titus as a model for the New Testament Jesus. And you assert that those stories were created from the Greek Septuagint, influenced by Homer and Euripides, in the light, these books were to, in the light of those two books, the Creating Christ and Caesar's Messiah. I mean, how do you think that those views line up with kind of your view? Because there's a little bit of similarity that there is Roman influence into the creation of this myth. How do you see it playing out between those different narratives on that? And what is your take?
Well, with Valiant, I think that he's got a lot of interesting stuff to say. It kind of boils down ultimately to this trademark symbol of the Flavian dynasty, the anchor with the dolphins around it, which he admits was inherited from the Seleucid Empire, and that Christians were using it. That doesn't seem that compelling to me, because if it was a widespread pre-Roman symbol, you can't necessarily exclude any other origin than Romans contributing this to the mix. They might have, but it just misses it by an inch to me. And though they have a real good point about Romans wanting to have a pacifistic Christ and all of that, to think of them as inventing the religion seems to me, and I know this is subjective and debatable, it just seems a little unlikely that they're foisting this hoax. They could have, but you do have a precedent with conquering empires trying to impose their religion or to influence the religion of the subject people, to pacify them. Hey, we're your friends. We're not trying to stamp you out. And the prime case, in my opinion, would be how post-exilic Judaism looks, with the Pharisees, looks just like Zoroastrianism, and that from the Persian Empire. And even the books of Ezra and Nehemiah tell us that when Jews who were civil servants for the Persians were sent back to sort of get Judaism off the ground again, they clashed with the indigenous Jews who had never gone into Babylon. And shortly thereafter, you've got the Pharisees as opposed to the Sadducees. Well, as T.W. Manson pointed out decades ago, Pharisee very likely is another way of saying Parsi or Persian, Zoroastrian, and that the Sadducees, who didn't believe in a coming Messiah, a resurrection of the dead, angelology, Satan, and all that, they were the old-time religionists. They didn't believe in any scripture beyond the Pentateuch, and they viewed the Pharisees as syncretistic innovators. Well, that looks to me like the Persians Zoroastrianized or Persianized Judaism. Now, what Valiant is saying is somewhat similar, but they're talking more about creating a new religion. I don't think you need to go that far. Again, a parallel. The Romans disbanded the Jewish Sanhedrin of Jerusalem, who had local autonomy. They could call the shots up to a certain point. After the war against Rome, they didn't just say, okay, no more authority for you. They allowed Jews to set up a exclusively religious Sanhedrin in Yavne up the coast. They said, now stay out of politics, but religion, that's up to you. It seems to me that would fit Brandon's theory better, that yeah, the early Christians were a revolutionary insurgent group, and they got the heck kicked out of them when their leader was crucified, like Spartacus and others were. And what happened? Well, were they going to hunt down and kill all the Christians? No, they did the same thing they did with the Sanhedrin. So, okay, you guys can continue on if you keep the heck out of politics and no more anti-Roman insurgency. Well, and then the apostles, whoever they were, said, sounds good. I mean, Jesus was is pictured anyway as a kind of a rabbi. So was Judas of Galilee, who led a revolt against the Romans. It's not like there wasn't any wisdom side to it or any genuine religiosity to it. It was just that that had led them to this political militancy. Well, now they simply retreated to the accommodationism of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were devout Jews, but they were willing to live under the Roman heel because they said, well, what's the alternative? Suicide? So I don't think you need Valiant's theory. It's pretty easy to explain it on the basis of Brandon's theory. I'm sorry, I'm going to such a jungle of weeds here, but it seems to me that his theory really is almost a kind of a fifth wheel. It's you've already got a good theory. Like, he has nothing to say about a historical Jesus. There's no role for Jesus in this thing, as he admits, because he's thinking of the Romans just foisting an alien thing. If there was a Jesus and he was a revolutionist, it's pretty easy to describe a parallel mechanism of adjustment, just like with the Sanhedrin. Now, with Titus, that's a special case. He and Joe Atwill have almost got me convinced that in the so-called Olivet Discourse or Synoptic Apocalypse, whatever you want to call it, Mark 13, that when it says they will see the sign of the Son of Man, and that's going to signal the destruction of the city, which is the initial question. Does Jesus is he supposed to be saying, they'll see me coming in the clouds? It's important that he does not put it that way. What is the sign of the Son of Man? Well, of course, he's talking about the book of Daniel and the abomination of desolation, the desecration of the temple. What I think it's exactly like in the book of Revelation. It speaks of the beast. And he says, now, I don't want to come right out with this, but let him who has wisdom, you'll know what I mean. His number, it's the number of a man, a particular man. It's 666, which had to be Nero Caesar. Yeah. and so on. Well, that's the same thing. Let the reader understand. And what he's supposed to understand is, oh, Jesus was predicting Titus. So I think we've been misreading it, that it was even supposed to be Jesus. When Jesus even says in that apocalypse, many will come in my name saying, I am he. That doesn't necessarily mean I am Christ. No, it's coming in my name could just as easily mean claiming to be prophets speaking in my name, saying, this guy, he's the one. So I think we've been taking a whole lot for granted, and I got to give credit to these two guys for that. Atwill gets into all kinds of other matters that are really tangential. I used to dismiss some of the parallels he makes between Josephus and the Gospels, like, I will make you fishers of men. He says, boy, that reminds me of Josephus' story of the Romans on the Sea of Galilee, spear fishing to kill Jewish insurgents in the water. I used to think, come on, but I have to admit he might be right, especially since there are a number of other ones, though they seem kind of weird. I wouldn't be surprised if they're a kind of satirical retelling of it. I don't know, but I have respect for his eagle eye on that. He gets into other stuff, like he tries to, for some reason, he tries to harmonize all the resurrection narratives with absolutely, forgive me, ludicrous results. I don't know why he bothers doing that. So you don't have to accept everything he says to see that he's got some good ideas.
Yeah. Okay. So I feel like you kind of touched on this a little, but I want to go a little more into this. Like, so almost every story in the Gospels and Acts can be plausibly argued as borrowed. Bart Ehrman refers to parts of the New Testament as plagiarism from other stories, some of it forgeries because they're written pseudonymously in the name of people. Do you see the evidence for this? But also, like, the creation of these stories, you kind of see that every detail in Jesus' life fits outlines of the mythic stereotype present in all cultures. How do you see the Gospels written in relation to, like, the hero's journey and, like, other maybe Hellenistic influences into, I guess, the creation of this story that we have in the New Testament?
Well, when you look at everybody from Oedipus to the Buddha, and just loads of them, Lord Raglan was the first to do this in a book called The Hero. And I think James Frazier, the author of The Golden Bough, said, I noticed you didn't include Jesus here. But I would have thought that would be irresistible. And Raglan told him, well, there are going to be big repercussions if I do that, and I don't want to face them. So he also thought Jesus fit. Well, what's the pattern? There is an annunciation by God or an angel or whatever. You're going to have an amazing divine son. And then there is some kind of miraculous conception. It might be a virginal conception. It might be a married woman, a wife who, however, is impregnated by a god, not her husband, Alexander the Great, Plato, the Buddha, and so on. But a miraculous conception nonetheless. Then there's a wunderkind, a child prodigy story, where the young god basically already knows more than his elders and makes them look like fools. There's plenty of that around. There may even be a contrast between the adult hero, if he's a healer, and professional physicians, just like Jesus with the woman with the hemorrhage. She wasted all our money on quacks, but now Jesus does the thing. There are healing miracles, of course. There are apparent resurrections that usually, if you look close, are not about people actually being brought back from the dead, like Jesus doesn't raise up moldering corpses, neither does anybody else. It's that somebody is saved from a premature burial because somebody comes up who is adept enough to discern signs of life, whereas the others hadn't seen it. That was a close one. And that may well be what is being said. Like when Jesus says, she's not dead, she's asleep. That kind of makes you wonder. Or Lazarus, he's not dead, he's only asleep. Then they get there and says, move the stone. Lord, he's been in there 4 days. It's going to be a hell of a reek. Well, they assume he's been dead for 4 days. They don't know that. But at any rate, there's that kind of a story and exorcisms and so on. The Savior is often a king or the heir to a king. He is acclaimed by the masses, but suddenly they turn against him, and he gets executed on a hilltop, oddly enough, for different circumstances. Then nobody is sure where he's buried. And there might be posthumous appearances to say farewell and or appearances, or just an empty tomb or the absence of a body, perhaps accompanied by a heavenly voice with Romulus, Apollonius of Tyana, and so on. And this occurs again and again. There's a couple of great books on this. Charles Talbert in the 70s wrote a book called What is a Gospel, where he details several of these. But recently, David Litwa wrote a book called Jesus Deus, How Jesus Became a Mediterranean God. I don't know how this guy does his research, but he came up with wheelbarrows full of close parallels in ancient Greek and Roman literature, so that stuff that most people knew. I mean, if we have copies of these things and they're the tip of the iceberg, you have to assume the ancients knew about it. And in fact, Justin says to pagans, he says, when we talk about Jesus' virgin birth and miracles and all that, you say, oh, yeah, we've heard about all that stuff. The sons of Zeus, the same thing. Well, what's the problem with Jesus then? Well, he admitted, of course, it is typical, but this one did really happen. That's simply a faith statement. And you have apologists today saying, no, all that stuff was copied from Jesus. Not a chance. The Baal, Osiris, Attis, they go back hundreds of years in some cases before Christianity. It's just cheap propaganda. So there is this pattern. Now, were these things borrowed from one another? Some of them could have been, but they're not as much alike in details to indicate that one was actually copied from another. It's more like great minds think alike, especially if you're living in a culture where everything depends on a harvest and you got the death and resurrection of vegetation and all of that stuff. So it's no surprise and that there are loads of these deities, and some in the ancient world made the connection. The Romans and the Greeks were saying, your Osiris sounds a lot like our Dionysus. I bet it's the same guy. The Naasenes, who were Gnostics, they said Jesus, Adam, Attis, they're different names for the same guy, and we're the only true Christians. We know that. It just seems to me, if the relation of the dying and rising gods is all an illusion, that's what you'd have to say it is. It's like being in the Matrix or something. I mean, if this isn't true, you got a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah. Talking about, I guess, the myth making around the dying and rising gods. One, is there proof of this in the New Testament that you can make the connection? I mean, other than the general narrative story. Then the other thing is, the process in the Roman culture of apotheosis, the making Caesars into God after their death, you think that played into the Christian narrative that we have to make our, that when it became part of the Roman Catholic, as I feel like they played a big role in the invention of the myth, that somehow in there, they needed to make their Messiah a god. And so kind of, it seems to me similar to like how the Caesars were made god after their death, and then their living, you know, heir is the son of God. Do you see that process playing into the myth making of Jesus becoming the son of God kind of thing?
Yeah, it's the general ideological or mythical thought world of the times. It just didn't. In Seneca wrote this thing, the translates as the pumpkinification of Claudius. It's a pun on the apotheosis. Anyways, the apo, I can't remember several syllables in Greek, where Claudius dies, and imagine the scene in Olympus where he appears there as a god, and somebody on Olympus says, "What, another one?" And it's they're just making fun of it. So it was widely taken for granted that you could become a god. I mean, even with Enoch and Moses in the Old Testament, they in Hellenistic Jewish thought, some homegrown mysticism like Merkava mysticism, they're already making those guys gods. Like Enoch becomes the lesser Yahweh and sits at the right hand of the older Yahweh, the Ancient of Days. What's going on here? I mean, you can see the Trinity popping up in somebody's mind with something like that. And though they always have the problem, well, gee, we don't want to be called polytheists. Is there some way of saying they're the same, but they're still not quite the same. But that's a product of trying to assimilate these things that fit more at home with polytheism. So it just seemed to me it was part of the mulch of religious thought back then, and had been for thousands of years with Baal and Osiris and so on. They died and rose, and you will too if you're initiated.
Okay, makes sense. So Paul states that he never knew Jesus personally. According to James Dunn, Paul presents in his epistles definitely a Hellenized Christianity. I'm curious as what you think the idea of logos and the demiurge, Platonism, Neoplatonism, and I guess like Plato's kind of view of like, I guess would be a Trinity, the creator God, I believe is the logos, the world spirit, and how that played into or influenced the writing of the Greek New Testament.
Well, I read a fascinating book by Russell Gmirkin, who is just a genius. He wrote several books on the specifically Platonic influence on the Old Testament, including Genesis, well, also the laws in Exodus, the Exodus narrative, and so on. But in the most recent one about Plato's Timaeus and Critias, he shows very convincingly that the whole idea of Genesis 1 with Elohim, who creates apparently a lower tier of gods, and then human beings, mirrors Plato's idea of there being this high god and the demiurge below him who creates the gods of mythology, and they create humans each in their own little fiefdom. Poseidon was the god of Atlantis and created the Atlanteans. And when they had a war with Athens and Poseidon decided to flood them all out, Gmirkin shows that has a lot of parallels to the flood of Noah, more than you would think on a first reading. And the fall of the sons of God and all that stuff, he has a totally different reading of it that makes new sense of everything. Mm-hmm. And so you've already got like the fundamental ideas of the Old Testament, which may be much younger than we used to think. Like Peter Lemke and Russell Gmirkin and others say, this seems to be a Hellenistic book. It may have been put together sometimes from older material, but put together at the time the Septuagint was translated, that they did the Hebrew and the Greek at the same time, and that it doesn't, it's not any older than that, again, though some materials are. And so the Hellenistic thing that permeates it makes perfect sense. And so it's already there before the New Testament is written, though not much before. Mm-hmm. And with Platonism, you know how Philo, who's was writing around the 40s CE or AD, he said that, boy, this is so much like Moses. I bet Plato ripped it all off from Moses, when, of course, it's just the other way around, though it wasn't Moses himself, but Jewish scholars who did. Well, yeah, there is a lot of similarity. And Gnosticism, as one scholar described it, is Platonism run riot, even with the demiurge. That very term comes from Plato. He was an inferior creator, just like David Hume said. There is an amazing amount of order and design in the universe, but not enough to prove the Christian God. Yeah, exactly. That's because it was created by this guy doing the best he could, but you know, what did he have to work with? The demiurge. So it's, and I think that Bultmann is right, that Gnosticism was already there and was a major contributor to Christian theology.
Yeah,
there's one other distinction I want to make. Jewish Christianity was a bit more like Islam, with the idea of the succession of the true prophets, and finally the biggie, there was the Paraclete Muhammad, and so on. It didn't have all the metaphysics of Hellenistic Christianity. Paul doesn't even come in for mention. So if Christianity in its Jewish form was more like Qumran, and they didn't have the idea of the atoning death of Jesus yet, where does Paulinism come from? And like, why is there an apostle Paul if there were 12 apostles? Where'd this guy come from? It seems like a whole different thing. Well, imagine, suppose you're a Jewish believer in Jesus and you go out on a mission to Europe and you're saying, hey, everybody, I got great news. The rightful king of, as we might say, of Liechtenstein has arrived. He's taken the throne. So what, where? Would that have been even relevant to Greeks, Romans, and others? I think not. And so to survive, it would have had to undergone this massive change conceptually into the form that we know was predominant there of dying and rising savior gods and atoning sacrifices and so on. And one last thing, I love what Harnack said in his book, What is Christianity? He said, you read how Jesus gives the parable of the prodigal son. If you repent, no matter how far you're gone, you just need to repent and God will forgive you. Can you imagine Jesus saying that when he knew that maybe a month later, everything would change? That wouldn't be nearly good enough. You got to believe in him as some kind of demigod and be baptized and take communion. Why didn't he say that before? I mean, how did the whole thing change? What the heck's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the change between what Jesus is saying in the Gospels and then Paul's theology is, they're two different things for sure. You know, fascinating. So, you know, the Greek Septuagint, the oldest Hebrew Torah we found at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is very similar to the language of the Greek Septuagint. So right. You might have something there. I mean, that's quite fascinating. I never thought of it like that. I would like to kind of end with like one of my final questions. I'm kind of curious about the objections to the historical Jesus and the Christ myth theory that you kind of present in the case against the case for Christ. What are the common like evangelical objections and ways to overcome those when presenting these ideas?
Well, one of the biggies is that they say, look, there just wouldn't be enough time between Jesus and the Gospels for these guys to have created a myth. Well, wait a second, that is totally circular. If there wasn't a Jesus, the bottom drops out of this. Where's the starting point? Enough time between the Gospels and what? I mean, it may have been germinating way back even in the Old Testament, because there's evidence that they even believed Yahweh, like Marduk, was a dying and rising God. Jesus may have been distilled from belief in Osiris and Baal, which the Old Testament makes manifest they knew about. So when would the myth have to have begun? They're smuggling in the idea that there was a historical Jesus. You can't do that. It's totally circular. I don't know why they don't see that. Let's see. Another thing Bart says in his book, Did Jesus Exist? I think it was called, there's similarity between Old Testament stories and New Testament stories, feeding of the 5,000 and stuff like that. But that's just the window dressing. The substance goes back to some kind of core. What substance? I mean, it seems to me like there's an empty shop window. It's all window dressing, abstract that stuff, what's left? And he said in a debate with me, oh, well, no, I'm not saying that that the whole thing was made up, but in his book, he actually does say that. So he'd sort of backpedal to get out of a tight spot. But that's important to say. You can't just say it's details. Take away these details and ask yourself, what have you got left? Another one is, well, Jews were very fiercely monotheistic. They would not put up with any influence from those pagan Greeks. No. What do you think the Maccabean revolt was all about? In the second century BCE, so many Jews are flocking to believe in Hellenism and Dionysus worship that Judah and his brothers said, hey, this keeps going, say goodbye to Judaism. I mean, there was a real threat. It wasn't like it was just that the Antiochus Epiphanes was converting people to Hellenism at sword point. People like this. Oh, I like the gymnasium thing and so on and so on. And we know they were open to Hellenistic influences, like the Dura Europa Synagogue has these big floor mosaics that show Hercules riding his chariot through the wheel of the zodiac. There's a North African Jewish sarcophagus that shows the Torah and the wheel of Attis, which is a symbol of his resurrection. What do you think Paul was worried about when he said that weaker brethren could be led off the track by seeing you, a deacon of your church, go into a business lunch at Apollo's temple? What's the problem? They're going to think, oh, I guess we can keep on worshiping several gods like I used to do. Well, great. No. It's just meat. It's not religion. That just doesn't make any sense either, that there was this hermetic sealing going on. Let's see what else. The idea that there are loads of pre-gospel sources like Q and L, M, Proto-Luke, or Marcus, and so on. So you see, it's not just the four gospels. They didn't come out of nowhere. They're based on a chain of earlier materials. Bard argues that way. No, we don't know that there were these things. These are merely hypotheses trying to divide up the text to make sense of it. They're alike in a lot of ways, different in a lot of ways. What might explain that? And there's continual debate on which of these theories, if any, is true. So again, you can't invoke one debate to settle another one, but they do that all the time. I'm sure there's other things. Well, another one is the gospel writers. It's either hoax or history. And these guys were all above board. They were honest and treasured that. They're not going to be lying to you. It's not a question of lying. And that brings up the question of forgery and so on. Yeah. That's kind of anachronistic, like Dennis McDonald and others show. There was this idea of mimetic creation in literature where you would say, the Iliad, the Odyssey, they are great. I think we could use another treatment of the same themes. And so you see all these big, unashamed borrowings. It's like when you see a remake of an old movie. They're ripping that off. No, it's just a redoing of the themes or even the letters. Now, some of those, I admit, are pious frauds where they're trying to uphold the higher truth by fibbing about it. Otherwise righteous people are tempted to do that. It doesn't mean that it's not like all or nothing. I'm saying there's a naivete and the bifurcation fallacy. It's either forgery or inspired or whatever. No, it's not. Come on.
A little bit of both. Very fascinating. Well, I really appreciate you taking your time. You covered some really good stuff today. Very insightful. Once I post this up, I'll go ahead and send you a link for it and everything. But I really appreciate you taking the time and appreciate your insight on all this.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.